Welcome to Dark Mode Once, a Twin Peaks podcast. Welcome to another episode. This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And joining us this week is...
Nate Fisher. Happy to be here, guys.
Woo! Yahoo! Nate, you just mentioned off-air that you've listened to this show before, so you kind of know how this works. So tell us what you've thought of the return so far.
Yeah, I prepared my answer in advance. Look, I don't want to tell anybody how they're supposed to watch something or enjoy something, but if you're watching the new Twin Peaks and you don't think it's the best television show of all time, give me your eyes because you're not using them.
That's a pull quote if I've ever heard one.
Mm-hmm. Starting off hot.
Well, this is definitely a very hot episode. I mean, if we want to kind of get the ball rolling here, I feel like maybe the topic of this episode to address is the concept of fan service and how this episode both serves it and kind of turns it on its head. I think we know what I refer to specifically with two examples.
Somebody made a really good point. I don't remember who it was, but they said that, you know, it's hard for this to be fan service because fan service as a concept implies that a show like catches wind of what its audience is thinking over time and then adjusts the show as it goes on to fit that. And Twin Peaks was conceived and finished before anybody got a chance to look at it. So the concept of fan service, at least from that angle, it's impossible unless you are one of the characters in Twin Peaks and you live outside of the space-time continuum.
As suggested by this episode, maybe the show does exist within its own universe. The actual, at least maybe the most fan service-y moment is the actual music kicking back in. But what it almost felt like to me was in Fire Walk With Me, which we should mention, the 25th anniversary of it coming out is today. So good timing. It sort of reminded me when you have the opening 20-30 minutes of that, the Dear Meadow section, so to speak, and then you cut to the Welcome to Twin Peaks sign and Falling kicks in, and you're kind of lulled in thinking, like you're stepping into the warm bath. Then there's the hard cut, which is, of course, Laura doing cocaine, and in this it also ends with a hard cut, which is Diane seeing the text message.
Yeah, I mean, there's no uncomplicated joy to be had in the episode, right? There's an amount of you stand up. I certainly stood up and, you know, cheered and yelled at the television when, you know, Agent Cooper came back to, you know, his consciousness. But, you know, this is an episode that includes like genuine a man kills his son. Diane reveals that she was raped, or at least maybe Diane. We don't know how true that is based on Diane's identity. But, you know, everything is juxtaposed between, like, you know, stuff that is supposed to make you feel good and stuff that is supposed to make you feel as bad as you possibly can. As for the, you know, swelling, you know, inspirational nature of the music coming back in, I mean, yeah, this is like example number 10,000 that, you know, this show is extremely self-aware and will wear that self-awareness on its sleeve.
You brought it up briefly, but Richard Horne, maybe the twist is he's actually the biggest millennial fail son on the show.
It's funny because Agent Cooper has that line where he says that he's 25 years his senior. And I think that means Richard is also 25, which I don't know. I just thought that was a really interesting, very clean generational juxtaposition between the two of them.
Yeah, it's funny because the revelation that Alpha Coop is indeed Richard Horne's father is maybe not a surprise, but something about the callousness of the way that information is conveyed, but also in a way the anticlimactic nature of it too, I found very intriguing, because it is conceivable that the show will just sort of progress from this point forward and not really make a point of bringing that up again. Granted, the final scene sort of throws that assumption into some doubt, I know, but how it's embedded into that sequence itself I found really fascinating, because we have what, for my money, might be the most horrifying death we've seen on the show so far, perhaps second only to some of the Ike the Spike killings with the stabbings and the bent spike itself. But I found the effect itself, the sound design and the kind of visual obscurity of it, to be particularly horrifying. And perhaps there was something kind of fan servicey about that, the big bad, or one of the big bads, I should say, getting his due. But it was one of those moments where there's something just so kind of offhand about it that it's really very jarring how it happens at the top of the episode. And it's even couched in this, or rather couched in it, is this comedic gesture of Jerry Horne not being able to manage his binoculars, which even the fact that Lynch maintains that visual gag through the scene of looking through the wrong side after the killing has already taken place, he cuts back to it. And it was a funny thing where in my viewing circle, when we were watching it, we all laughed hysterically at the first shot from the wrong perspective. And the second time there was just nothing. It was just dead silent. I thought the whole moment was kind of lovely. It also implies that he is very, very close to the town, because you can't imagine Jerry Horne has actually gone that far stoned out of his mind in what, 2-3 days? So.
Well, I think kind of violence is an interesting theme of this episode, or at least actually I thought it was a more particular theme was kind of a subtle theme was firearms throughout this episode, how it seems like every citizen has one in this episode. I think of course, the action sequence that follows that, maybe after the fight scene in episode 7, the actual kind of first actual like full on action sequence in this show, and Bushnell Mullins having just a gun casually on him. Diane having a gun.
Him so casually giving the gun to this guy who's been basically catatonic for the last several days. Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. Thing, Dougie.
I mean, this is the extreme amount of gun ownership has been, you know, a very visible theme going, you know, as far back as, you know, when that kid shoots through the double R in that really strange scene. I don't remember what episode it was in, but it really does, you know, insert political metaphor here, but man, everybody consistently has been armed to the teeth.
I mean, there's actually a Lynch quote about this. I mean, we've kind of discussed Lynch's politics on a past few episodes, but there's actually a quote he had, I think it was taken in the 90s, or sorry, the 80s, about gun control. Let me just... This country is in pretty bad shape when human scum can walk across your lawn and they put you in jail if you shoot them. I think this was in the late 80s when he was an avid Ronald Reagan voter.
Nice.
Man.
I found
this... So Blue Velvet means a whole lot different thing than you imagine that the entire surface of suburbia is the good part.
Yeah. I found this essay couched in a tweet that says, "Melts my mind seeing people praise David Lynch when Gran Torino was an explicit parody of his alt-right politics by Clint Eastwood."
Clint's the new leftist filmmaker we all need.
But, I mean, if we want to talk about action, I think this is, we could surmise, I mean, I brought it up last week, the show is kind of kicking into high gear, but would we say this had the most that actually happened in it of any episode?
Perhaps. I mean, just with regards to moving the plot forward, it really, every scene was kind of incident driven, right? I mean, are there any sequences that didn't have some kind of narrative driving force behind them?
The only one I can think of is Gordon Cole observing the technology in his in their little room there.
Yeah, which I thought was a particularly odd moment. It definitely has sort of a kinship with the later sequence with Diane, I think, kind of the sense of something closing in. But that's a good point.
Yeah, I don't want to go too out on a limb here, but, you know, Lynch's performance as Cole in this episode in particular is really, really strange. Like, I just watching the way that his, you know, face reacts to what Diane is doing and saying, and of course the fact that he can, you know, predicts when she arrives at the door, he knows who it is. Like, all of that is, you know, I can't say for sure that it's not just, you know, part and parcel to the Twin Peaks world as it is, or if it doesn't hint at something, you know, more sinister. But it was just, I was mesmerized by it and I couldn't shake it. Also, just David Lynch is doing just A-plus work for a director who has to act. Like, I've done, it's hard. Like, I don't know where to look. And he knew exactly where to look.
What makes you say sinister? I'm curious.
It almost seems like anticipatory. Like, he's almost like caught wind of it, and he's like kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, he seems like what's about to be revealed is something that he can almost see coming.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess I took that as more detective's intuition than anything else. I mean,
yeah. Sure. Maybe I'm just going down, you know, one rabbit hole.
Sure. Well, for me, it was a thing of, the great eye acting on Lynch's part, looking at Diane's bag. I thought that was really beautifully calibrated, that shot reverse shot dynamic, kind of the spacing and the blocking of the actors themselves, him and Dern, and how you can tell exactly where he's staring at any given moment, and how his eyes just very casually but also tensely flit towards the bag and back up. That was a great little suspense moment. It was almost Hitchcockian, mm-hmm. in kind of the way it's these little building blocks. It's kind of the temperament of it is very piece by piece, and all the pieces are kind of whirring at the same moment, but some in a higher gear at various points. That was superb, I thought.
Well, I think the whole Diane scene that preceded it, again, I brought up before when there's the hard cut to the text message and everything, but to me that whole, there's, I guess you could say it's a 5-10 minute sequence in and of itself, from the text message to her getting whisked away, so to speak. But that actually is what I was getting the most Inland Empire vibes from in anything in the series so far. In that, throughout a lot of Inland Empire is her just presenting monologues, essentially an actor playing an actor, so to speak. And it kind of, you got that vibe from just her sitting in that chair, essentially almost as if she's performing a monologue you're seeing three people. Whenever you kind of see a audition scene in a movie, usually it's three people sitting at a table facing against one person. And again, I like Bront, friend of the show Bront. I actually don't know if I can call him friend of the show, but he brought this up on Twitter. One of the great choices in that scene is that he doesn't cut to the memory. He lets Dern sell the moment entirely. And one, of course, other thing I have to mention, of course, we get the return of Lynch's American Woman remix.
Oh, yes, we do.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, from the first episode.
Yeah, but I didn't know. Wow. Hmm. Yeah.
That was 3 months ago. I don't blame you for forgetting.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to watch the first episode and just be completely shocked at all the things that I don't remember.
Are you just gonna kind of zone out on the couch for the whole 18-hour marathon on Sunday?
Gosh, I want to, but there's gonna be too much sports is gonna be on Sunday. I won't be able to resist.
First time that's been said on this podcast.
Ooh.
Yeah, what of it, nerds?
Nate is literally dunking a basketball over top us right now.
I'm the jock of film Twitter.
Well, I mean, do we want to talk about kind of the Cooper waking up sequence a little further in terms of, did you feel like it felt rushed or just right, or it was almost treated as a joke, or?
I think it was kind of in many ways treated as a joke, definitely, because there's so much humor flowing through it. It is definitely the self-reflexive winking line, finally, from the one-armed man, which, you know, I mean, that you kind of contain the entire thing in that one line, couldn't you? But also, yeah, just kind of the humor of him saying, you know, hand me one of the sandwiches, I'm starving, because it is more, it's the first thing he's consciously eaten in a quarter century. And I would say also kind of the whole thing with getting the gun from Bushnell Mullins and, sure, Dougie, whatever you say. I liked him sort of springing into action that way. And it being a kind of there being something not necessarily grandstanding about it is what I guess I would say. What's interesting is that I expected his return to basically be what we saw last week, which was in essence his return. But I expected to be something where he hears a particular thing and his brain just kind of snaps back together and suddenly he's him again. The way that it happened here, I think, is in a way more mysterious, just because he hears this thing and then he puts the fork in the socket. But as he's putting the fork in the socket, he still seems like Dougie, sort of. Like, he still has kind of that that somnambulance to him, let's say. Definitely more initiative, but a certain kind of somnambulance still. And then he goes into a coma, and then when he comes out of it, he seems to just remember everything and have been conscious of everything somehow. And there's something that goes unspoken there that I found very intriguing.
Yeah, I agree with that last point, because, like, if you look at, you know, one of these timing things of, like, did this feel rushed? Did this, you know, happen too quickly? Maybe in the context of the episode, like, the scene itself is very, very, you know, quick. But, you know, in the context of an 18-hour movie, if you consider the scene that came before it with, in the last episode, of him putting the fork in the electrical socket, like, that suddenly, like, that seems to, like, it's much more gradual and makes a lot more sense. And then, you know, like, every moment in that scene is juxtaposed against the 12 hours we spent with Dougie. And so the rush and the rapid, you know, return to normalcy is really the only, like, logical way it could go.
Again, though, I think kind of Cooper's happiness or drive maybe is short-lived, because I think once he actually gets back to Twin Peaks, shit's gonna get dark.
You know, I was thinking about this, because I know you've said you're expecting it to go in a pretty dark direction, and I guess, sure, that's possible, but I wonder if, I don't know. I mean, the last note of the episode is definitely pretty dark, but I wonder if we are being set up for something kind of triumphant.
Well, what I kind of feel like is, because it's suggested here that, again, the one-armed man has the seed, and he gives him his bit of hair, and he tells him to make another one. So my prediction is Good Cooper will die, but will live on as another Tulpa that has a closer resemblance to Good Cooper than OG Dougie, so to speak. That's my prediction.
You don't think he's going to just, like, send a Dougie back, and that we spend the entire episode 18 watching the return to domestic normalcy of the Jones family?
That's season 4, Nate.
Oh, yeah. And it's like a three-camera sitcom.
That would be good.
I would watch that.
It could be like Rabbits. Well, I mean, if we want to talk about, again, the other big event, which is the Audrey scene, this is sort of another confirmation, I feel like, of another theory, which is that she's in a coma of some sort. But I thought something that was interesting about that was, about the sequence itself, at least her going to the Audrey's dance sequence, is how it sort of recalls the Wild at Heart club sequence where Cage and Dern go to a metal show and then Cage takes the mic and starts performing and the whole crowd starts swaying to him. This is sort of a interesting quotation. I mean, we've talked about how a lot of The Return is mixing and mingling other Lynch motifs, but I thought that was an interesting callback.
So some comments about the Roadhouse scene. First of all, Eddie Vedder's performance wasn't as bad as I think we were all expecting. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I will say kind of the sort of emotional pull between the narrative and the song was maybe not my favorite thing. Just Eddie Vedder going like, I wanna be a man, I wanna be, or something like that. Not my favorite thing, but the song itself was okay. But are we to understand that Eddie Vedder is being dreamed up by Audrey then?
Well,
because
Pearl Jam did start in Seattle, so okay. It's possible that she would, you know, have her finger on the pulse of emerging music in the early 90s.
What year did Pearl Jam form, though? 1990.
Okay. The year Twin Peaks. The timing works okay. out.
Yeah, well, if Twin Peaks season like 2 takes place in 1990, there is a chance that, you know, Audrey, being the town hipster, saw one of the first garage Pearl Jam shows before they were big.
Sure.
And then, you know, managed to rope that memory in to her dream reality. But like, as I said on Twitter, like, who among us hasn't brought their, you know, artistic heroes into their dreams? Mm-hmm. She just happens to be a huge Eddie Vedder fan.
Sure. That's very possible. But one thing I found kind of fascinating, this relates to something that we talked about a few weeks ago, is how this sequence to me feels like another instance of the show sort of folding our real world into the Twin Peaks world. Just because it's interesting to me how the song that they perform is Audrey's Dance, one of the, you know, maybe 3 best-known Twin Peaks themes behind the theme song and the Laura Palmer theme, maybe. Maybe tied with Dance of the Dream Man, I don't know. But they use the name of the song, right? Mm-hmm. And she does the dance, which she remembers very well. I mean, it makes sense that she'd remember it, I suppose, since in her mind, the events of the original series happened, you know, like a day ago, basically. But they play the song, has the same title, and she does her dance to it in this very, fan servicey but self-referential way. And it's fan servicey, of course, up to a point, because then it's this very dreamy sequence from the original turned into some sort of, I don't know, Paul W.S. Anderson nightmare, kind of?
Hell yeah, brother.
Because it did kind of look like a thing from one of the Resident Evil movies, the white room that she's in. And which to me, I mean, the thing it brought to mind was the was in the original series when Major Briggs gets sort of abducted by aliens or something. And you have that very strange image of the hooded figure with the white background going through. This is also something that is described, I think, in Mark Frost's Secret History of Twin Peaks, his time in that particular space, Major Briggs' time in that particular space. And I brought this to mind. I kind of wonder if there's an overlap there, that this is the same sort of liminal purgatory of the Twin Peaks world that we got a quick shot of. I also, again, I'm kind of looking forward a bit again, but I would not rule out the possibility that we don't see her again, that that's kind of the end of her story. I think it would be a good spot to end it, honestly. Just kind of end with that thing, leave them hanging, and, you know, yeah, just end it there.
Well, it kind of brought to mind how, I mean, we all know that Mulholland Drive, at least the seed of it, it originated as an Audrey spinoff from Twin Peaks. So, I mean, I'm kind of wondering if this whole subplot with her is scratching a bit of that itch.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I would say a lot of the show itself has felt, at least maybe more the early hours, felt very Mulholland Drive-esque. He's definitely tapping into that vein a bit, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've felt more Inland Empire than anything. But no, I see where you're coming from. I'm much more wedded to the this is the Paul W.S. Anderson moment, and she's going to fight her way out of a subterranean lair with the help of other characters from other David Lynch films.
Like Richard wow. Pryor in Lost Highway, yeah. Sting in Dune, William H. Macy in Inland Empire.
Sissy Spacek from Anthony The Straight Hoskins Story.
And The Elephant Man.
Yeah, John Lurie from Wild at Heart.
Obviously, the lawnmower from The Straight Story.
Yeah, Anthony Hopkins from The Elephant Man. All the stars. The Dick Tremaine guy from On the Air, Crispin.
All six figures from Six Figures yeah. Getting.
Crispin Glover in Hotel Room. Yeah, the list goes on and on, really.
Hmm.
Billy Ray Cyrus from Mulholland Drive. hopefully. I mean, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me.
Duran Duran.
Well, that's, yeah, it's like the ending of Inland Empire. Like, I'm still holding out for some, like, blatantly metatextual ending to it. I think that would be completely in keeping with the show, and it would be absolutely just my favorite way for it to end. Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, it seems pretty certain that the last musical guest will be Julie Cruz. So that could be sort of a hat tip in a way. Mm-hmm. And whether or not it will actually end the series or not, you know, remains to be seen, obviously.
Julie Cruz introduced by Andrew Dice Clay.
From the Roadhouse in Twin Peaks, United States. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe just the announcer can put on his Dice Man gear. I don't know.
I guess, I guess I would say, so I want to talk maybe a bit about the Cooper return, just because it kind of got me thinking about just kind of how on Twin Peaks generally, there's almost no happy moment that can be entirely happy, because I just got to thinking about for me, the return of Cooper sort of crystallized the Cooper-Dougie-Alpha-Coop triangle, let's say, and how there's almost been this new split that we've seen, where even though it was him physically, and in a certain way it was him mentally, everybody saw him as this different guy, and he assumed another man's identity, and how now that figure, who we saw on the show for all of 90 seconds, you know, months ago, has taken this position, how he's kind of been launched back into the show in a way he hasn't been before, and how the consequences of it, of course, are this woman who has newly fallen in love with her husband is now being left by the husband, just as he's kind of just as the ideal man actually comes into the picture, right? And this son is being left by his father, just as the ideal father is leaving. And I don't know, I found that really very sad, in part because I could kind of see that being the end of the line for those two characters.
Yeah, it was a very Spielbergian moment. It was very, like, it was uncomplicatedly, like, Hollywood heartstring pulling, but offset by the fact that it just takes place, like, at hip level, surrounded by slot machines, which is just a really just great way to make it just always seem somewhat ironic, and also just to give it just a really incredible background. Like, you just will never see that again. Like, you'll never see a scene like that take place at that height in that location.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved that. It was incredible.
Yeah.
I wanted to, one of the many things that I was noticing because I watched it right again, like as soon as it finished, I like got online. I was like, all right, I got to A, do some research, and B, I kind of want to watch this again. So I watched the whole episode again. And one of the things
A legal streaming service, Nate.
Oh, I did use a legal streaming service. I used Showtime, but, I was tempted. You know, I love these illegal services have proved good for me in the past. I can send everybody some sites if you need a couple streaming sites, especially for sports. But I was watching the episode again, and I just, especially to hear like some lines that I couldn't hear before. And one of Diane's last lines is that she's saying that she's in the sheriff's station. And to me, that seemed like, all right, so if there is a real Diane, that real Diane's soul, for lack of a better word, is trapped in the woman from, I don't know the actual character name, but the woman in the jail cell that they picked up in the forest, mm-hmm. right? Do we have any thoughts on what that connection might be?
Well, kind of like a white soul trapped inside an Asian body would be a nice quotation of Mr. Tojimura from season 2.
The return.
I mean, I think that idea is neat, but again, there's a part of me that just dreads the IndieWire think piece about it.
Oh no.
Well, the first chapter of it's already been written, so yeah. We'll just get the addendum, really.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also dreading the, I know this is in somebody's head, probably listening to this podcast right now. I just want to say to you, don't write a piece that ranks all the episodes. Don't do it. Please. We've all thought about doing it. You could make $100 doing it. Please.
It's $100 better earned just doing a hard day's work at the blank factory.
I hate that we all immediately get that joke.
Too online.
So maybe we should, I don't know, should we finale predictions or I don't know.
It's the two-part finale next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way, it doesn't feel like it because, you know, it's because we watched hour 16 of 18, but yeah, it's going to be hitting us, and in less than a week's time, we'll be done, which is obviously very sad. But what, I don't know, I mean, I guess, you know, expect the unexpected, of course. But, you know, it definitely, to me, feels more than ever like a high wire thing now, because you don't want them to blow it at the last moment, obviously. I don't think there's reason to believe they will blow it, mind you, because I think that they've been weaving a good thread thus far. But still, you know, it's kind of like there are a lot of pieces in motion, and I know not all of them will cohere. I mean, you know, intentionally so will not cohere. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, you know, dig back through my memory files and dust off, like, which characters have I not seen in a while. First of all, Wally Brando, where's he been, huh? Like, he needs to come back. But yeah, it's, I have, you know, nothing but sky high expectations for the finale. You know, I didn't want to get my hopes up, but I waited 10 hours, like a requisite amount of time of not getting like crazy amped. And now I've thrown all my critical faculties by the wayside. I'll go back in like 6 months and like try to be smart about this, but I'm just expecting an extremely cathartic, like, you know, very fan service moment. Like I'm fully engaged in that mode. The question that was posed to me was by a friend was, is this the last thing David Lynch is ever going to do? And I said, yes, of course it was, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, for a man that smokes as much as he does, he actually seems in pretty good shape. So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was some stirrings about a year ago that he was actually planning on making a film after this, that he had something in mind. Apparently, he was going to be partly inspired by Tangerine, weirdly enough, the Sean Baker film from a couple years ago.
He's secretly shooting on an iPhone, just like Soderbergh.
Yes, exactly.
Wait, he can shoot a movie on an iPhone, but we're not allowed to watch a movie on our iPhone?
I don't know if it's a one-way street, but anyway. I don't know. I mean, there was also something where today Kyle MacLachlan did a Twitter Q&A, and he sort of joked, winked about there being more after this, but I kind of don't see that happening, in part because I think there's a decent chance Cooper does not come out of next week alive as well. I think there are definitely odds of that the way things are going. But yeah, I mean, it would definitely, David Nevins of Showtime himself has said that he's waiting to hear from Lynch about it. And, you know, I mean, given how much he loves the world and the characters, which is what he says in every interview, it's not impossible, but something about this definitely feels summative, both for the show itself and for him.
I think he will
funneling so much of himself into it.
I think he will direct a Marilyn Manson music video. That's my prediction.
I'm sure there will be, you know, music videos and sculptures and maybe a few new songs or something.
He'll do a commercial for, I don't know, Amazon. We'll do an Alexa commercial.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, I mean, my only prediction, maybe I don't really have any predictions other than it ending, as I said, I think a few weeks ago, I think it's going to be ending as, I think it's going to be, have closure, but in a way be as upsetting as the ending of the original series. But what I do hope happens is they do, you know, like the end credits of Predator, where they do like the kind of, how they credit the cast, where it's like them giving a thumbs up to the camera. I hope they do that with like all 230 cast members of the entire series at the end, and it'd likely be a 15 to 20 minute end credit sequence.
And it's like all of the scenes that like they appeared in.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, yeah.
Well, they have the Bowie, tin machine like sort of lift its spout.
You see a hand like poke out of the machine, just give it thumbs up.
I guess we're all unsure, but I think we're all optimistic.
It's so interesting, if you had asked me how I felt about what the finale was going to be before I watched last night's episode versus now, and I would have had honestly like a lot more to say. Like I feel like so much has been streamlined, and so much has been, I don't know, almost made deterministic by the way this last episode shook out, that like you're going into the finale not knowing necessarily what's going to happen, but with a certain sense of confidence that, oh, whatever how this ends, it can't not make some level of sense. Like, everything is going to make sense to me in some way or another. And it's not just optimism saying that. It's like, look at the way that this story has been told over 14 hours and tell me that landing isn't going to get stuck somehow.
It's a good way of putting it. I mean, my last hope is that, as was revealed with John Cena and Herman Cain, I hope we have, like, a third kind of unlikely Peaks fan to complete the trilogy revealed for next week, hopefully.
Cato Kalin. It's the first one that comes to mind. Or Monica Lewinsky, actually. That would be.
The 90s are back, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Folks, if you think you know a great fan of Twin Peaks celebrities, sound off in the comments. We'll be responding to each of them.
We'll do a live stream just for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also maybe worth pointing out that even this won't 100% be the end, because we do have the Mark Frost book coming out on Halloween, which
is going to be full of his Louise Mensch tweets.
God damn it.
I don't.
Oh, I do. I certainly do. I get that FDR icon popping up every so often.
I can't do it.
No, it's fair. You're not missing much. I mean, there's sort of a perverse fascination I have with his tweets, just because it's so kind of beltway liberal MSNBC viewer. It's sort of endearing because, you know, he means well. Like, you know, yeah. he's not on the other side. It's just sometimes it's like, man, did you have something else to do with your day?
No, and I just started reading the novel thing that he wrote before the show. He does a lot of like interpretation of American history and talks a lot about, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Meriwether Lewis in the first few pages. And yeah. I can't get, you know, his political perspective out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to, it sends me down these rabbit holes of things I should not be thinking.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, The book itself is pretty fun. Like, it is a very ornately designed thing. Like, clearly a lot of care was put into it. And he's kind of playing in his playground. Lynch himself apparently has not read the book. Like his response to an interview was, it's his secret history. So the extent to which it can actually be taken as canon, I think, is kind of debatable. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to the follow-up book too, just because it is a fun thing. I guess I wonder, because it's supposed to bridge the gap between the series in terms of what characters were up to and sort of allude to mysteries that have sprung up in this new show.
Did either of you ever read A Series of Unfortunate Events growing up?
I did. Yeah.
That is exactly what the Twin Peaks book reminds me of.
That's a good comparison, actually.
I would say so, yeah. Even like the... Even the color of the page sort of looks like the illustrations. I didn't think of that. So, yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
It just came to me. No, please edit this into the podcast that I was a – no, please edit into – I was a child actor. This is all true. I was a child actor where my mom wanted me to be. She wanted to be like a theater mom. And so she made me go to a bunch of auditions. And I was one of the like last four auditioners, like callback, to play one of the kids in the Jim Carrey Series of Unfortunate Events when I was like 10.
Holy crap. Wow.
And I often that was my Timothy Treadwell almost getting on Cheers moment.
Man, you'd be too big for us. You wouldn't be on this podcast.
I know. I would have so much money. It would be amazing.
You really just lost out to Ned Rifle for how hard the fans out there.
and maybe, you know, maybe it's for the best. Maybe you would have been one of those bratty, you know, famous kids, and you would have been like an Edward Furlong maybe, and we'd be like looking at you right now. You'd be bloated and like just have, you'd be like, you know, just
I would be in the Roadhouse on Twin Peaks.
Yeah, probably.
I'd be acting in Twin Peaks, playing a character on meth and not doing well and not looking well, but fat, getting to act in Twin Peaks.
Fat Caleb, I would Landry Jones.
I would trade it. I would have a terrible life just to be in two scenes of Twin Peaks: The Return.
Nate, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me on twitter.com. It's a lovely website. If you're not on it, get on it. We have a lot of fun on there. It's a place where normal things happen in a normal way.
I'm at
Fishing with Nate on Twitter. I'm also going to give a plug for a podcast I'm starting. Cause you know, you can always fit more movie podcasts into your life. I believe that wholeheartedly.
I thought it was going to be a sports podcast.
What's that?
I thought it was going to be a sports podcast.
Oh, no. I would do this. I don't know enough about sports. That's the problem. I have a very bad fan's perspective on sports. No, I'm doing a movie podcast with a friend of mine who has the exact same name as me. Mm. This is not a bit. We actually do have the same name. We haven't come to agreement on what the title is. He doesn't know that I want to call it Movie Yaks with Nate Fisher and Nate Fisher. when he hears this, surprise. But that's the working title for now. And so, yeah, just give me a follow on old Twitter and look out for me and other Nate Fisher's movie podcast.
Shameless, these boys are good boys ripoff.
What? Why?
No, I'm just joshing you.
You just wanted to get a good boys reference.
Yes, please listen to that. I mean, again, you can find me on twitter.com/EthanVess. And if you really search deep and dark, get into those you know, those crevices of the internet, you can find my work Twitter. But that's the challenge. That's the riddle. You got to find the coordinates for that.
Oh, that's what... Oh, is that thing that... Did you follow me with that?
I feel like I may have accidentally.
I think that's what it was. I was like scratching my head going, what is this? Is this a bit? Like, are you making a character or something?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Nick, where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/Nick_Newman, thefilmstage.com, and Real World Doings with Grasshopper Film. Also, Ethan, I found your alt account.
Oh boy.
It's just subtweets and nudes. That's all it is.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for joining me. And whew, man, next week it's all gonna be over. What's there even to look forward to? Bring a bacon and I'll put it in a pan.
you know, the life in the 1970s in the Sunset Strip, it wasn't easy. You know, they made you laugh, but they were really hurting inside.
Man, now
do you think he watches Dice?